Okay, so let's get started here. There's a homework due on Friday. Just keep that in mind. As I was just mentioning, submission for the homework is also through Spire. Okay? I'll put up a short note on the discussion board on if you handwrite it and you need to scan in your homework and then submit it, on how to go about doing that. As a PDF scanner, it's very easy. Just stick in a paper, a PDF pops out, and you can just upload to Spark. You have a question there? Okay. Okay, so first programming assignment is done. Okay, I hope everybody managed to submit it on time. I haven't heard anything otherwise. There's homework out. There will be another assignment that will be handed out soon. Okay, I need to cover some more material on synchronization before you're ready to do that. So it will be on threads and synchronization in some form. Okay. Are there any follow-ups from the discussion yesterday? How is the discussion section going? Is it adding to your knowledge of threads and so on? I mean, that was the discussion section yesterday. Anything I should know to make it better for you guys? Did everyone go to the discussion section? Okay. And did you get something out of it? Yes.
In terms of the grade for like the project you just passed in, does that count like towards the grade, or is that just
the first assignment? Small part of the grade. It will count because you put in the work, so it's fair that you should get something for it. But it is not going to be a major part. The subsequent one is the first real programming assignment. Okay, this one just a warm-up, a refresher. Okay, anything? Okay, so if you have comments, come talk to me. The discussion section, as I was saying, is supposed to supplement what we do here. I'm trying to make sure it does. If you want something in the discussion section or want follow-ups, want review of some lecture material, we can do all of that. Okay, so let me know. So let me do a recap of last class before I talk about scheduling today. So the last class was mostly focused on threads. Okay, it's important that you understand this notion of a thread because you will be programming in threads in a couple of weeks. The thread is basically a sequential execution stream within a process. Okay? The notion of threads generalize the notion of a process. A traditional process is essentially a single threaded program. There's an address space and there's one execution stream within the program. Okay? There's something executing and there's only one stream. If you generalize this notion to having a single address space that is shared by multiple execution streams, there are multiple different parts of the program executing concurrently. Each of these parts is referred to as a thread. Each thread has its own stack. It has its own set of registers, okay, but all threads share the address space, okay, and you can use threads to do different things within your application. Okay, one thread could be asked in a browser, for instance. One thread could be responsible for rendering HTML, another one could be responsible for parsing, a third thread could be responsible for fetching pages or images from the network. Okay, so you can take any large application, partition it into different functionality and assign each functionality to a thread. Okay, that's how most modern multi-threaded applications are written. Okay. So we talked about two types of threads, kernel level threads and user level threads. Kernel level threads are threads that kernel knows about and can take advantage of in terms of scheduling. User level threads are threads that are written in a user level library. User level threads are faster than kernel level threads because all thread management is done in a library using library function call. There is no need to go to the operating system using system calls to create threads or manage kernel level threads. Okay, in the case of user level thread. Okay, but that said, the scheduling of kernel level threads is better in terms of an application as a whole. Okay, because the kernel knows about them, so it can give more CPU time to a process that has more kernel level threads than a user level thread. If any thread in a user level threads process blocks, the entire process blocks. Okay, that's not the case for a kernel level threads, because the kernel knows about it, it only blocks one thread, and but it can schedule the rest that are still ready to run. Now, that said, in a user level threads process, you can pick a library with whatever scheduling algorithm you want. We'll see several scheduling techniques today. Okay, all of these techniques, which today we will study in the context of kernel, can also be implemented in a user level threads library. Okay, so you can pick a different scheduling algorithm by picking a different library in the case of user level threads. Okay. One thing that I did not mention about user level threads and kernel level threads is the ability to take advantage of multiple processors. Okay. Modern laptops, desktop servers are multi-core systems. Okay. They have more than one processor in them. Okay. If you have a kernel level threads support in the operating system, any application that is using kernel level threads can take advantage of this multi-core system. Okay, you can run thread 1 on core 1 and thread 2 of the same process on core 2. Okay, so you can basically run as many threads in parallel as the number of cores. If you have a user level threads program, since the kernel doesn't know about the presence of these threads, it just views this as a traditional process. So even if there are 100 threads, user level threads in that application, that process will always be scheduled on one and only one core. Can never run on more than one core. Okay? So this other thing which was not mentioned last time is user level threads cannot take advantage of multi-core system. Okay? Kernel level threads can, because the kernel knows about them, can explicitly schedule these threads, okay, on different cores. Something to keep in mind. Okay? So towards the end of that last class, we started talking about scheduling. This is basically the problem of which process or which thread gets to run on the CPU. How does the kernel make this decision? There are several policies, okay, that I'll talk about today. And basically, you have to pick the one policy that is most relevant for your system. Yes.
Is it possible to write a program that runs on multiple cores?
Is it possible to write a program that runs on multiple cores? Absolutely. If you write your program using multiple threads, okay, and this program runs on a system with kernel level thread support, automatically your program will run on multiple cores. You don't have to do anything, because the CPU can actually schedule. If two threads are ready to run, they are in the ready queue, they can get scheduled on two cores. Okay, so trivial thing is you write two threads, each does an infinite loop, your two core system will run on these two cores and max out your CPU. Okay. So let's talk about scheduling algorithms here. So there will be several that we'll look at today. I'll start by talking about what are the goals for CPU scheduling. What do we want from our scheduler? And then I'll talk about several policies. Okay? First come, first serve, and round robin. SJF, which is called shortest job first. Multi-level feedback queue, which generalizes this notion of shortest job first. And lottery scheduling. Okay? These are just some of the many scheduling algorithms or scheduling policies that are out there. But this is a good representative sample. It gives you a sense of what each scheduling policy does in terms of its goals. Okay, what does it optimize? What does it not optimize? So let's start talking about goals. So just to remind you, what we are now talking about is short-term scheduling. This is distinct from long-term scheduling. Long-term scheduling is the problem of how many processes should I even allow in my system. Okay? And once these processes have entered the system, they are ready to run. Short-term scheduling is the problem of picking the right process to run on the CPU. I said towards the end of the class, there are two versions of short-term schedulers, non-preemptive and preemptive. Okay, we'll see examples of or policies that belong to each of these category today. Non-preemptive systems are one where once the kernel has chosen a task to run, it basically gets to run on the CPU until the task decides to give up the CPU by either blocking or finishing. Okay? The OS will not interrupt it. In contrast, a preemptive system is one where the OS can interrupt the task, can either ask it to relinquish the CPU or do something. Okay, so that's the key key difference rather between non-preemptive and preemptive systems. Any questions on this? Okay, so we look at the difference between the two using policy. So here are the goals that you might want for your scheduling algorithm. Okay, you might want to optimize any of these criteria. Okay, there are several listed here. So the first one says CPU utilization. This is the percentage of the time the CPU is busy. Okay, given a set of jobs or tasks, okay, we'll use the term a job to refer to a process or a thread. Okay, this is a generic term. We will not distinguish between the two. As far as the CPU scheduler is concerned, it doesn't matter. So we'll just use this more general term called a job. Okay, so given a set of jobs, okay, if you pick a scheduler that maxes out the CPU, okay, that's a better scheduling algorithm from your perspective because it's making better use of the resources on your system. Okay, so CPU utilization is one criteria you might want to maximize using your scheduling algorithm. Okay, throughput is basically a metric which refers to the number of processes or the number of jobs rather that finish per unit time. Okay, so if you're given a time window, okay, so let's say that's time. Okay, and there are different processes that are finishing, applications processes that are finishing at different point in time. Let's say this is a window of time t. Okay, so you take the number of jobs that are finished, you take the time. Okay, so then let's the number of jobs is n, the time is t. That's the throughput of your system. That's the number of jobs finishing per unit time. Okay, that's called a throughput. Okay, you might want to clearly maximize throughput of your system. If you have computational jobs that are running, the more jobs that you finish, the more you have accomplished. Okay, so that's another criteria you might want to optimize. Okay, turnaround time is basically the length of time it takes a job from the start to the end. Okay, so if there is a job that has started at, so let's say this is time, time t, job arrives at, let's say, time T1. Okay, this is when you start off, your double click your application, new process starts, it runs and it finishes at time T2. Okay, the turnaround time is T2 minus T1. This is the, called the turnaround time. That's the time that the job took to finish from beginning to end. Okay, you might also want to minimize the turnaround time for a task. Okay, that's yet another criteria. Okay, yet another one is waiting time. This is the time that a process is spending in the ready queue of the system. Okay, it's ready to run, but it's waiting for its turn. Okay, so it's not doing anything useful. Some other task may be running, other some other job may be running on the CPU. This task is waiting for the CPU. It's not waiting on IO, it's waiting to run on the CPU. Okay, so waiting time is basically the total time that a process has spent waiting in the ready queue. Okay, so if you take the turnaround time of a task, this is the time that is spent from beginning to the end, some fraction of this time it actually ran on the CPU. Okay, so let's say it ran from on the CPU. Some fraction of the time it spent doing IO. Okay, so let's call use that black. Okay, and then some other fraction of the time it basically has finished IO, is waiting to run. Okay, and that fraction is referred to as the waiting time. So basically anything that's not either blue or black in that thing is waiting time. Okay, because when it's black, it's waiting on doing IO. When it's blue, it's running. Okay, so you might want to wait. As you can imagine, if you reduce the waiting time, the turnaround time will shrink. Okay, because the total work that the job is doing is basically only the black and the blue. Okay, and the red, it's just waiting to run. Okay, so you might want to minimize waiting time. So we'll look at a policy that does optimize waiting time, okay, in a short while. Okay, the last criteria is the response time. This is important for interactive jobs, okay, jobs that are actually interacting with the user. Okay, it's the time between when a process is ready to run and the next IO request. Okay, this is how a user perceives its application responding. Suppose you do a mouse click. Okay, this may cause an event that the system has to do something. Okay, and the time when you actually see the system doing something in response to your mouse click is the response time. Okay, you might actually type something on the keyboard. Okay, if the system is very slow, there may be a perceptible latency when you actually see these characters appearing on your screen. Okay, that difference in time is referred to as the response time. In interactive jobs, in interactive systems, it's important to optimize or minimize the response time so that the user actually sees a good performance or good response time from the system. Okay? So these are different criteria. Okay, as we will see, you can, ideally you want to pick a policy that would optimize all of them. They all seem like worthy goals. Okay? You want to maximize utilization, maximize throughput, minimize turnaround and waiting times, minimize response times. Okay? But it so happens that depending on the policy you choose, if you try to optimize one or some of these criteria, you do it so at the expense of some others. Okay? So you, there isn't one policy that is going to optimize all of them. Okay? So you have to pick which criteria is most important to you for the system you are writing, okay, for the operating system you are building. You have to pick the policy that then optimizes that criteria, and that will often come at the expense of making some other criteria worse. Yes, I will see all of this in example policies. Okay, so ideally you want to optimize all of them, but you cannot, because sometimes you do some optimize one and you make some others worse. So ideally you might want to pick a policy that minimizes response time, minimizes variance of the response time. This is the how variables are the response time, because predictability may be more important than a low average time, low average response time but high variance. Okay? So this is more predictable. Okay, and that is just low average. Okay, you want to minimize throughput. This typically means you want to minimize the overhead, okay, the OS overhead, which is basically context switching time, okay, as well as efficient use of system resources, okay, faster I/O or better I/O and so on. Minimize the waiting time when the processor, and we'll see that can actually make the response time worse. Okay. So we'll see policies that do one or the other, okay, but not necessarily all of them. So the policies we are going to look at will make the following assumption. Okay. We'll assume one process per user, okay, one thread per process, okay, meaning that we don't really in these policies consider multi-threaded applications, just for simplicity. Okay. So single-threaded process. Okay. And we'll assume processes are independent. Okay, they are not cooperating processes. If they are cooperating processes, there are dependencies which makes things worse. Okay, for now, we will not assume there are any such dependencies. Okay, the policies that we are going to look at here, so the policies that you are we are going to look at here are all very old. Okay, they have been designed back in the 70s, but they still apply to modern systems, okay, in some shape or form. Okay, so these are the policies. I've already mentioned some of them. So we'll start with FCFS, first come first serve, very simple policy. We'll look at round robin, shortest job first, multi-level feedback queue, okay, which is essentially a combination of these two policies, okay, and lottery scheduling. Okay, so let's start with FCFS. Okay, as the name suggests, what the FCFS policy does is it schedules jobs on the CPU in the order of their arrival. Order of their arrival into the ready queue. Okay, so there's a ready queue, jobs are arriving, they are queued up. Okay, and then you just take the task at the head or job at the head of the queue, schedule it, okay, let it run. Okay, it might finish at some point, and then you take the next job, let it run, and so on. Okay, so this is referred to as a non-preemptive scheduling policy. Okay, because by definition, you are just letting the job run until it either finishes or it blocks on I/O. Okay, at which point it will go into the wait queue. Okay, so the CPU scheduler in this case is not interrupting the job and making it relinquish the CPU and it will not run another job. It is just scheduling jobs very simply in their order of arrivals. Okay, so it is non-preemptive. So this is a classic example of a non-preemptive scheduling policy. Okay, very simple example here. So the time is on the x-axis here. So what this is showing is arrival order of B, C and A, three jobs. Okay. Job B arrives, and so the ready queue has the order B, C and A. We'll assume here that the jobs don't do any I/O. So you pick job B, you basically give it the CPU, it runs until completion. Okay, there's no I/O, so it's just going to keep running because it's not a preemptive system. So it will run at some, and let's assume it takes time 2 to finish. Okay, so it's going to finish at time 2. Okay. At this point, the CPU has become idle again. CPU scheduler has to pick another job, and only C and A in the ready queue, it picks C. C gets to run. Job length is 3 here, so at time 5, C finishes. There's only A in the A there, so A is going to run. Okay. And if they had arrived in some other order, A, B, C, they would run in that order. Okay. The total time at which they all finish is still 10, because the order in which they run has changed. Okay? And if the job does IO, for instance, if the arrival order was ABC, but let's say A does IO, so here A is running on the CPU and its job length is 5. But before it has finished execution, it has done some IO. So at this point it will block. Okay? So it will go to the wait queue, which will let the scheduler pick the next job, which is B. So B is going to run next. Okay? It takes 2 time units. Okay, that's the length of B. So at time 4, B is done. Okay? At this point, the scheduler has to pick another job. So if A is done with its IO, it would come back to the queue. Okay, and it gets to run because it had arrived first in the system. If it hasn't finished, then it's obviously only, there's only C, so C would have run. So here the assumption is A has finished, so it gets to resume and it finishes, and then C gets to run. Okay, this is called FCFS, a very simple policy, first come, first serve. Any questions on this? Okay, so you could be asked to say what is the waiting time in this case. Okay. So what's the waiting time for, so let's take the first example. How much time has B waited? Okay, 0, because it arrived at time 0, it got to run immediately. So there's no waiting time for B. Waiting time for B is 0. What's the waiting time for C? Okay, 2 time units, because it arrived, all 3 have arrived at time 0. Okay. C started running at time 2. So it was waiting in the ready queue for 2 time units, okay, until it got to run. Okay, so the waiting time for C is 2. Okay, waiting time for A is 5. Okay, it also arrived at time 0. It began running at time 5. Okay, so waiting time for B is 0, for C is 2, and A is 5. Okay, so if you're asked what's the average waiting time, you just take these 3 numbers, 0 plus 2 plus 5, okay, and then you divide by 3. Okay, that's 7 by 3 is the average waiting time. Okay, yes. Yes, so I haven't even come here. I was just explaining this example. Okay. So in this example, this is how you compute the waiting time. Okay. Now let's come to this bullet, which was the question here. So if they did not all arrive at time 0, okay, they arrived, let's say, 1 time unit apart. So in this case, the order of arrival is still B, C, and A. Okay. But the waiting time is going to be different. Okay. For instance, waiting time for B is still 0. It arrived at time 0. It got to run at time 0. C has arrived next, but it arrived at time unit 1, okay, and it still has to wait until B finishes, so it arrived at 1, it got to run at time unit 2, okay, so in this case, the waiting time for C is 1, okay, and A has arrived at time unit 2, it gets to run at time unit 5, okay, so its waiting time is 3, okay, so if the arrival times are not all the same and they are different, then the waiting times will also change. Okay, so you need to be able to compute the waiting time based on the time of arrival and the time at which this task actually gets to run. Okay, so before we move on, so this is the most simplest policy. Advantage is very simple. The scheduler doesn't have to do anything, just has to implement a FIFO queue, ready queue, tasks arrive, you take the task at the head of the queue, run. Okay, and then you wait for it to either block or complete, and then you take the next task. Okay? Now we'll see that the average waiting time is highly variable in this case. Okay? And the reason for this is this. Okay? So you might have long jobs and short jobs. Okay? If a long job just happens to arrive before a short job, and then this long job gets to run, it's going to run for a long period of time before the short job runs. So all the subsequent jobs have to wait. Okay, this increases arrival waiting time. This is very similar to driving on a freeway behind a truck. Okay, this truck basically slows everything down and there's a long queue behind the truck. Same thing. Okay, if you let the short jobs go ahead, then the overall waiting time is reduced. Okay, yes, question there. Does the operating system know if the jobs are going to be long? Typically, the operating system does not know. Okay? We look at the shortest job first policy, which tries to do that, but that's a problem. Okay? Because when you start an application, what does the operating system know about this job? It knows it's an application. It doesn't know how long you will run, when you will terminate it, what it will do. So typically, this knowledge is not known. Okay? But if you had known the length of a job, you could have optimized it by preferring shorter jobs. Okay. So job waiting time is highly variable in case of FCFS. Okay. This might also lead to poor overlap of IO and CPU because of this problem. Okay. This might lead to poor overlap of IO and CPU. If there are some CPU bound jobs already running and they run for a long time, there's an IO bound task that just wants to run for a short period and then it blocks, okay? But it has to wait for a long time for its turn, okay? As a result, the overall waiting time in the system increases, okay? If you could somehow prefer shorter jobs, which also in this case they also mean you prefer IO bound tasks, then overall waiting time will be reduced. Okay? Because this job runs for a very short period, it relinquishes the CPU, goes back to doing IO. Okay? So might as well run it and then move on and then actually run your CPU bound tasks. So that would be a better policy for reducing waiting times. Yeah, but FCFS doesn't do that, it suffers from that disadvantage. So next policy is round robin, also very simple. Okay, so as the name suggests, you basically cycle through the jobs in some order, okay, in round robin order. Okay. This is a preemptive policy. Okay. The only way to cycle is if the job, if some job actually has to run again, so you will have to preempt jobs. So what happens in this case is you have a queue of tasks that are in your that are in the ready queue. You take the one at the head, you let it run. Yeah, but you don't let it run until completion, you give it a time slice. Okay? You give it a certain amount of CPU time, let's say 100 milliseconds. Okay? So if it runs through its entire time slice, then it has to relinquish the CPU. Okay? It gets kicked off the CPU and it goes back and has to wait at the end of the queue. Okay? So then you take the next job and you run it and so on. So you will basically cycle through all the jobs. Each one gets, let's say, 100 millisecond time slice. And then once you are done with all of the jobs, you start the next round and so on. Okay. So this only works if the system is preemptive. Okay. Preemptive scheduler means, as I mentioned, a preemptive system is one where the operating system can interrupt the CPU and make it force it off the CPU, make it relinquish the CPU. Okay. So after each time slice, you move the running job or the running thread to the end of the queue. Okay. So it has to wait for its turn again. Okay. Now the issue here with round robin scheduling is how are you going to pick this time slice? Okay. So if you make the time slice large, okay, in the degenerate case, if you have very large time slices, round robin will basically become same as FCFS. Okay, let's say you pick time slice of 1 hour and all jobs are shorter than 1 hour. Okay, first job that gets to run will run till completion. Okay, because it has a very long time slice, it doesn't need the whole time slice. So if the when you make the time slice very large, round robin starts approaching the behavior of FCFS. So you don't want that because you will get all of the problems we saw with FCFS. Okay? If you make the time slice very small, saying I will try to make it as small as possible to give everyone a shot at running on the CPU, then this has other problem, which is there's excessive context switching overhead. Okay? After every time slice, you have to do a context switch. Okay? You have to save the state of the job that just ran, take all of its register, save it to memory, restore the state of the next job on the queue. Okay, that is wasted time. Okay, because nothing is nothing useful is happening. So OS is doing bookkeeping. Okay, so you want to amortize your context switch overhead, okay, over the time slice. Okay, but you neither want the time slice to be too large, okay, because then you amortize your context switch overhead, but the scheduler is giving you bad behavior. It's approximating FCFS. But if you make it too small, okay, then the context switch overhead starts impacting the efficiency of your system. Your throughput is going to start dropping, okay? Because for every 1 millisecond of context switch time, you're basically wasting over your entire time slice. So time slice may start approaching the size of the context switch. Okay? So you want to balance these two trade-offs. Okay? Ideally, you want to pick a time slice where the context switch overhead is roughly 1% or lower. So the amount of wasted work you are doing for 99% of useful CPU cycles you spend, you do 1% of bookkeeping. But that's an acceptably low overhead. So what does that mean? I mean, so in modern systems, this effectively results in time slices that are in the order of tens of milliseconds. Okay, so 10 to 100 millisecond is typical. Okay, Linux has like 100 or 200 millisecond by default. Other operating systems use as low as 10 milliseconds. Okay. And this is known to be good enough because the context switch is in the order of hundreds of microseconds. you then run for 10 milliseconds, so your basically wasted overhead is much smaller as a percentage of the total CPU time. Is that clear? Because some time back when we were talking about context switch, I said we'll come back to this issue and discuss how do you pick the time slice. Okay, that's basically the most important criteria. You want to ensure that the context switch overhead is amortized, and you don't want to pick something large enough that it has bad behavior. Yes. Yeah. Question is, does FCFS not use time slices? FCFS does not use a time slice. It's a non-preemptive policy. Okay. You basically pick a task and you let it run. If it takes 1 hour to run, you let it run. You never ask it to leave. Okay. That's basically FCFS. So it is, that's what I said, it is non-preemptive, there is no concept of time slice there. Okay? If you add a concept of time slice to FCFS, you get round robin. Okay? Because you basically make it relinquish the CPU and it goes back to the end of the queue. Okay? So FCFS plus time slicing is round robin, effectively. Okay? So FCFS is a non-preemptive policy. Once you pick a job, you will let it run for as long as it needs. It could take minutes, hours, you don't ask it to relinquish until it either stops or it does IO. Okay, those are the only two reasons why a job will give up your CP. Okay, any other questions on round robin? Okay, so the advantage is it is fair. Okay, you are basically giving CPU time to all of the ready tasks. Okay, so each one gets a turn. So in that sense, it's fair. Disadvantage is average waiting time can still be bad. It is not optimal. It's better than FCFS, but it is not optimal. And we'll see policies that can do better than round robin in terms of waiting time. Okay, so here is another example. Okay, you have 5 jobs. Okay, so job 1 through 5, each has a length of 100 time units. We are assuming here that they have all arrived at time 0. Okay, we'll assume that they all have a time slice of 1 second. 1 second time slice, context switch overhead is 0. We will neglect the context switch overhead. So then the issue, what you are asked here is, when does each job finish? What are the completion times of the jobs? If you had run the same set of jobs using the FCFS policy and that set using round robin, and then you are also asked what is the wait time, okay, in the FCFS and under round robin. Okay. So FCFS should be simple. Okay. So when is job 1 going to finish? At 100. Okay. Job 2 is going to finish at 200. Okay. 300, 400, 500. Okay. Because they are arriving, they are serviced in that order. Each one takes 100 time units. There is no time slicing there. Okay. So each one is allowed to finish. Okay. What is going to happen in the case of round robin? Okay. How does the scheduler actually schedule them? Yeah. First one runs. You'll get 1 second. Okay, there's no IO here. Okay, so assume that no IO. So it gets maximum of 1 second. Okay, well that's the context time slice. Okay, so it'll run for 1 second. Okay, and then it has to go to the end of the queue. And job 2 runs for 1 second. Okay, it'll run for 1 second, it goes to the end of the queue. And then 3 runs and 4 runs and 5 runs. So at the end of the first round, each one has run for 1 second. Okay, and each one has 99 seconds of computation to do. Okay. And you go and do this another time. Okay. The second round, each one runs for another second. Okay. Okay. And then once each one runs, they go back to the end of the queue, wait for their turn. After round 2, you have basically each one has 98 seconds of computation to go and 10 seconds have elapsed because each one has actually run for 1 second and so on. So if you continue doing this, you will see that at time 496, okay, this one will finish. Okay. 497, 498, 499 and 500. Yeah, because you basically each of them needs 100 turns on the CPU. You take 100 second job and chop it up into 1 second computation, they need 100 turns, okay, before they will finish. Okay. And if you have 5 of them and you cycle through them, then this one is going to finish at time 495, 496, 499, this will finish at 500. Okay, so I'm going to now put up the solution here just so that you see the difference. Okay. So this is basically has finished at 100, 200, 300, 400 and 500. Okay. And these are all finishing more or less at the same time because you are cycling between them. Okay. Here you are basically favored this job. Okay. It got to finish 400 seconds before this job. Although they all arrived at the same time but in a certain order. So you preferred that job. Okay. So you will see that as a result the completion time has varied quite a bit. Okay. And round robin is fair because they all arrived at the same time. They all got a similar share of the CPU. So they all ended at the same time. It was all identical, equal length job. In that sense, it's more fair. Now, as a result, although it's more fair, you will see that the completion time here, average completion time is 498. If you take all of that, take the average, completion time is 498. Here the average completion time is 300. If you take these three and take the average, is 300. Okay? This is has more unfairness, but it's giving you better completion times. Okay? That's the trade-off I was talking about. So you make it fair, but then everybody is all finishing at the same time, which means the completion, average completion time has increased in the system. So there is always this trade-off. Okay? And which one should you pick is up to what you want from your system. Okay. Now the next column there is wait time. Okay. The wait time is always the completion time minus the arrival time. Okay. So in this case, wait time is for this task, FCFS is 0. Okay. Here it's basically 200 minus 100. It's 100. It's 200, 300, 400. So here basically you will take this finished at 496, time 496. Of that 496 time, it spent 100 time, 100 seconds doing computation, so it's waited for 396 seconds in the ready queue. Okay, and so on. So the simple formula to compute wait time always is as follows. Okay, so wait time is completion time minus the length of the job minus the arrival time. So this formula will actually always blindly give you the wait time. So it's always, in this case, arrival time is 0, so this doesn't matter at all. So you take the completion time and you take the length, and the difference between the two is the time that you spent on in the ready queue, the time over which you have been waiting in the ready queue. Okay, so that's what this shows. So this column is essentially this column minus this column. Okay? And the wait time for the round robin is you take the difference between these two quantities, and that's always that quantity. Okay, that's basically a mechanical way of figuring out your wait time. Okay? So you will see these are the wait times, these are the averages. Okay, the average waiting time here is also higher. Okay, because the completion times are higher. Any questions on this? Okay, so you should understand how to do these for each of the policies we are going to talk about. I'll do several examples today, and this is the kind of exercises you should expect on an exam or homeworks. Okay, yes.
So if you had like a transfer that context switch, where in the formula would that be?
Okay. So if you had a context switch overhead of non-zero, somehow you have to add that first to the completion time. So if your context switch was something, you basically you have to run for 100 seconds. Every time you run, there's an additional penalty you pay. So your completion time is going to increase. You will take longer to finish because that additional wasted time gets added. Okay? So completion time always goes up. Okay? So now the question is, should you add that to the wait time? So I don't think your wait time is actually going to increase. Yeah, although the system is doing context switch, you're still not running. You're still in the ready queue. Okay? So this formula is going to hold even if the context switch times are non-zero. Okay? The only thing that will change is if the context switch time is non-zero, the completion time will change. So it will actually change the completion time here, but the formula itself won't change. Okay? Any other questions on this? Okay, so here is another example. Okay, so different length jobs. Okay, so job 1 is 50, for these are the length of the jobs. Okay, they are still all arriving at time 0. Arrival times are all identical. Context switch time is still 1 second. I'm not context switch. The time slice is still 1 second. Context switch time is 0. Okay, so you can just repeat the same thing we did last time. Okay, in FCFS, this job runs first, finishes at time 50. Okay. This job runs next, takes another 40 seconds. Okay. So it is going to finish at time 90. So this one finishes, this was started at 50, it takes 40 seconds. So it finishes at 90. This one starts at 90, takes 30 seconds, finishes at 120. This one is going to finish at 140. And this one is going to finish at 150. Okay, so FCFS should be simple. So round robin is something you'll now have to start working out, okay, because job lengths are not identical. Okay, so it's still 1 second of context switch time. Okay, so this one runs for a second, okay, and then it relinquishes the CPU, then this one, and then so on. So after the first round, basically you decrement the amount of time each one needs. Okay, so now that one needs 49, okay, 39, 29, 19 and 9. Okay, so you do this 10 times, okay, and then this is going to finish by that time, because this only needs 10. After 10 rounds, this is the first job that is going to finish, because it has received 10 seconds of CPU time. Okay? So, when does that happen? Time 50. Okay, because you need 10 iterations, each iteration takes 5 seconds. Okay, so at time 50, this one is actually done. Okay, so this has a completion time of 50. Okay, at this point, there are only 4 jobs remaining. Okay, this one is gone. Okay, so these 4 jobs are going to round robin. Okay, there are these 4 jobs. Okay, so this needs 10 seconds of computation time, that needs 20 seconds, that needs 30, and then because each of them has received 10 seconds already. Okay, so then you cycle between these 4. Okay, and you'll see, so this is basically what it is. So you'll see that after 4, after 10 more iterations, that finishes. So that's basically 90. Okay, so this finishes at time 90. Okay, these 3 jobs have still some computation left to do. Okay, so then the round robin will just cycle between these 3. Okay, and each one will get 1 second in turn. And then this finishes at time 120, 140 and 150. Okay, so you need to understand how to do round robin. Okay, so basically you will start with all of the tasks. Okay, you will cycle between them until one of them finishes. Okay, once that finishes, you put it out. Okay, and then you have some other jobs remaining, and you cycle between them until another job finishes. Okay, and then you kick it out. Okay, and then you stay with the rest until you are done with all of them. Is that clear, what I just said? Any questions on this? Okay, so you'll see that the average completion time is actually identical in both cases. Just and it happens to be the choice of the length of jobs and so on. It's not always going to be the case. In the previous example, you saw that the round robin gave much worse completion time. Here, the job lengths were such that they actually ended up giving identical completion time. Okay? You'll see that basically it's 50 plus 90 plus 1. So these are the same numbers here. Okay, just in a different order, so you get the same average. Okay, wait time is this formula. Okay, so you take basically this and this, that's the difference with wait time here. 90 minus 40 is the wait time there, 120 minus 30 is the wait time here, and so on. Okay, and you do the same thing for round robin. Okay, completion time is 150, length is 50, wait time is 100. Okay, that should always be clear, because if it finished at 150, at time 150 seconds, of that it spent 50 seconds on the CPU, it must have been waiting for the remaining 100 seconds. Okay, that's essentially what the difference gives you. Okay, so that's the wait time. Okay, and so on. You will see that the wait times there are also, the average wait times also end up being identical. Okay, so again, that doesn't mean that the two algorithms behave similarly, just so happens that in this example they do, okay, in terms of their average behavior. Any questions here? Okay, is this clear how to do it? Yes, you have a question.
What about more arbitrary examples?
Yes, you can get more arbitrary examples. Yeah. There may be IO.
But they're kind of all lined up here, so.
Yeah. We'll see some more examples where they don't all arrive at zero and so on. So things that could be different, right? This is, you might have jobs doing IO. Here none of them do IO. Okay, if they do IO, they don't use their entire 1 second time slice. Okay, they might only use a fraction of that time slice and go back into the wait queue. Arrival times might not all line up. Okay, here we assumed everything arrived at time 0. That may not be the case. And context switch time may not be 0. Okay, typically that's harder to account for, so we will not look at examples where context switches are non-zero. Okay, but that's what makes it a little harder to do the math. If you had a program, it would be easier to do. But if you have to do it by hand, it's a little more complicated. Okay, so the two variants of these kinds of examples are one where the jobs don't all arrive at time zero. Okay. Job lengths can clearly not be the same, okay, as is the case here. Okay. Different length jobs, different arrival times, okay, and the fact that they might do IO, some jobs might do IO. Okay, we'll see some variants of this. So keep that in mind, we'll have some more examples coming right up. Okay. Next policy, shortest job first. Okay. This was something that was alluded to before. Okay. Why not take the job that has the shortest time, okay, the shortest length job, and execute it next. So you have a ready queue. Okay. You are not going to take the job at the head of the queue. Okay. You are actually going to look at the length of the job and pick the one that has the shortest completion time, not the completion, shortest job length. Okay, and run that first. Okay. Then you again look at the ready queue, say what's the next job, okay, which one is the shortest job, you run that job next. Okay. That is why this is called SJF, or the shortest job first. Okay. If the job does do IO, okay, there is a variant of this which is called shortest remaining time first, or SRTF. The reason you need that variant is if the job actually does IO, then you don't next time it comes back into the ready queue, you don't look at the total length, but you look at the remaining time. How much more time does it have before it finishes? Okay? That's the remaining time. Okay? So either look at if there's no IO, the two are identical. Okay? Because you pick the shortest job, it runs to completion. So it's short, the length of the job and is the same as its remaining time. Okay? But if the job actually pauses in the middle and does IO, it goes back to the wait queue. When it comes back, you actually look at how much more time is remaining, not the total length of the job. Okay? That's the variant. Okay. Now it is this, as you will see, actually you can have a preemptive version of this as well as a non-preemptive version. Okay, you can actually give it the CPU until it runs to completion, or blocks on IO, or you can time slice. Okay, you can have time slice version of SJF or a non-preemptive version. Okay. The preemptive version also referred to as SRTF. Now you can show that this is provably optimal with respect to minimizing wait times. Okay. You can do no better than SJF. Okay. This is the algorithm that will give you the minimum wait time always. Okay. There is a proof for that. We will not look at the proof. Instead, we will just see examples, and you will see in the examples actually it does give you better waiting times. Okay. So optimal algorithm in terms of waiting time. Okay. What's the disadvantage of SJF? How do you know what's the shortest job? Who's going to tell the scheduler? Sorry? The queue will tell the scheduler. How does the queue know? When you start, I mean, think of your, if you, this was something you implement in your OS, you start a process. Okay, let's say you start your browser. OS knows nothing about how long you're going to keep the browser running, when you quit. You cannot predict. Okay? So basically, an optimal algorithm, but one that can never be implemented in practice. Okay? Because you cannot know what is the length of the job. You can guess. Okay? So you can have heuristics that try to approximate shortest job first by guessing that I expect this job will take this much. But it's a guess. If you're guessing wrong, then you're not going to get these properties. Okay? So you can never accurately implement this algorithm, although it's optimal in terms of its waiting time, simply because you can never predict. Okay? The amount of CPU time the job is going to need. That's one problem. Second problem, okay, is that it can cause starvation. There may be scenarios where there will be jobs that are in the ready queue that will never get to run. These jobs will starve. Okay? Simple example, let's assume there is a long job and there are sequence of short jobs. Okay? Long job arrives at time zero, short job also arrives at time zero. Okay? Shortest job first will pick the short job. Okay, and it will run. Okay, let's say just before this short job finishes, the next short job arrives. Okay, so this short job finishes, it goes out of the system. Then you have two more jobs now. There's a long job and a new short job. Okay, shortest job first will again pick the short job. Okay, it will run. Okay, and just before it finishes, let's say another short job arrives. And so on and so forth. Okay, so this job policy will, all by always favoring short jobs, might actually starve long jobs. If there's a steady sequence of short jobs always entering the system and sitting in the ready queue, this long job will never run. Okay? It'll just sit there forever. Never get a chance on the CPU. Okay? This problem is called starvation, where you are starving the long job by not giving it CPU time. Okay? It's a big problem with shortest job, or any starvation is a problem with any CPU scheduler. Obviously, it's the worst form of unfairness. Okay? You are not favoring certain jobs at all, never giving them time on the CPU. Okay? So you never want a policy that does that clearly. Okay? And shortest job first has this other problem. Even if you could guess the CPU time, okay, which you cannot, but even if you could do that, this problem you cannot avoid. Okay, because there will be some jobs that you might never run, especially in a heavily loaded system where there are lots of jobs. Okay, and there are some mix of short and long jobs, but long jobs will not run. Okay, if you have a loaded system and you are running SJF, the long jobs will stop. Yes.
Let's say you knew how long jobs were going to take. Wouldn't you also waste a lot of time storing the queue to know which job to run next?
Okay.
So you had 10,000 jobs, you improve wait time to know.
Yep. So that's a good question. The question is, if somehow you knew the job length, okay, and then you had lots of jobs, let's say you have 1,000 jobs in your ready queue, it's a loaded system, then wouldn't you waste a lot of time trying to pick or find the shortest job? Okay, that's absolutely true. Okay, now, if you actually implement shortest job first, you wouldn't implement your ready queue as a queue. Okay, you will use some other data structure like a heap, which always sorts the job. Okay, by the length. Okay, this is also referred as a prioritized queue or a heap, where the thing at the head is always the one that is the shortest. Okay, you will have to use some other data structure, not a simple FIFO queue. If you use the FIFO queue, and you will end up doing a linear search through that queue, which will be very inefficient. Okay, for SJF. So you will not implement SJF as a FIFO queue. The ready queue data structure will actually be something else for efficiency reasons. Yes, you will have to. If you use a heap, in a heap, insertions are log n and deletions. Finding the shortest job is constant time. It's the one at the head. That's guaranteed. Okay? But when a job becomes ready, you have to put it into this data structure. In a queue, you just append it to the end. Okay, that's constant time operation. But here, you will have order log n operation. Okay? So it's not as much the scheduling, but when something becomes ready, inserting it into the data structure is not efficient. And that is all part of your context switch overhead. It's all additional bookkeeping the system has to do, because it is implementing a certain policy. Okay? And that's the price you pay. Okay? And so these are the issues that you have to think of with respect to any policy. Okay? How efficiently can you implement it? Okay? How much context switch is involved? What properties does it give you? Is this clear? What the shortest job first? So here is an example, same example that we did last time. We already did these two columns. Okay, now we have a SJF column. All jobs are arriving at time 0. Okay, different length jobs. Okay, and we will assume. Okay, so this is a time slice of 1 second. Okay, so let's do this non-preemptive version first. Okay, assume the time slice only applies to round robin. This is the non-preemptive SJF. Okay, so it's going to pick the shortest job, which is this one. Okay, that gets to run first, finishes at time 10. Okay, there's no IO here. Okay, so this one is done. So now there are 4 jobs remaining. Okay, you pick the next shortest job, okay, which happens to be this one. Okay, it gets to run next. And it's going to finish at time what? Time 30. Okay, this one finished at 10. This one needs the 20 more seconds, so it finishes at time 30. Okay, so at time 30, you have 3 jobs remaining. Okay, you pick the next shortest job, which is this one. It needs 30 more seconds of CPU time, so it finishes at time 60. Okay, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that is what you get. Okay, so this one finishes at time 10, this 10-20, this 60, this 100 and 150. You take the average, you get a completion time of 70. Okay, lower than FCFS, lower than round robin. Okay, now if you look at the waiting time, okay, waiting time is always the difference between the completion time and the length. Okay, arrival time is 0, so it doesn't matter. So you take the difference between these two. Okay, wait time is 0. Okay, take this one finished at time 90, needed 20 seconds of CPU time. So no, not 90. This one finished at time 30, needed 20 seconds of CPU time, so wait time is 10, and so on. Okay, so if you basically get 0, 10, 30, 60, and 100, you take the mean, you get a mean waiting time of 40. Okay, as I was saying, you will see that the wait time there is the more optimal, so in this case it turns out to be lower than the other two. Okay, and that's, you can prove that you can do no better than this. Any questions there? Is this clear what the shortest job first does? Okay, you could be asked to look at the preemptive version of this, okay, which does time slicing. Okay, just for just as an example, consider what would happen if you did shortest job first with time slicing. Okay, it's almost like a round robin with time slicing, except that you take all the jobs and you don't pick the one at the head, you always pick the one that is the shortest, at the shortest remaining time. What do you think will happen? Okay. So if there are no arrivals, there is no difference between the preemptive and non-preemptive version. Yeah, as was pointed out. Yes, you have something to say.
Check so often.
Yes.
It'll be worse than
yes. So if your context switch overhead will not be zero, if it, since here we are assuming it's negligible, you can check infinitely fast. Okay, so it takes zero overhead, so we don't account for it. But you're right. I mean, all of those overheads will add up. Okay. So just to clarify, if you had a time slice version of shortest job first, what would have happened? Okay. You would first have all these jobs come in. Okay, you pick the shortest one, which is this one. Okay. It gets to run for 1 second. Okay, so it ran for a second, it gave up the CPU. Okay. It has 9 seconds left. Okay, it goes back into this ready queue. Okay. And you pick the shortest job again. In this case, the shortest remaining time first. This has 9 seconds of CPU time. This still has 20, that still has 30, 40 and 50. So it just pick this job again. Okay. So you'll do this 10 times. Okay. It'll run for 10 consecutive time slices, still finish at time 10 seconds. Okay. Only difference comes if these jobs end up doing I.O. Okay. If the job ended up doing I.O., then let's say this job did an I.O. after its first time slice, then it would no longer be in the ready queue. Then you will time slice using shortest job first across these four jobs. Okay. But if there is no I.O., the preemptive and the non-preemptive version behave exactly the same way. Okay. Because you give it some time slice, that job has actually become shorter. It was already the shortest job. It ran for some time, now it's even shorter. Okay, so we'll continue to pick that job until it finishes. Okay, so there won't be any difference in what order they finish as a result of this. Is that clear? What happens for SRTF? Okay. So now there are two problems with shortest job first. First one is that you cannot implement this in practice because you don't know the length of the job. Okay, second problem is it can suffer from starvation. Okay. We'll try to see how can you address the first problem. Okay. How can you implement a scheduling algorithm that tries to approximate shortest job first behavior. Okay. But yet it doesn't need any knowledge of the length of the job. Okay. Because you don't know the length of the job, yet you somehow want to pick the shortest job because minimizing waiting times is good. Okay, because it also helps you optimize the completion time. Okay, that part is good. We like that part. But we don't know what the completion time is. So how can we come up with an algorithm that does approximate that behavior? Okay. That algorithm is called multi-level feedback queue or MLFQ. Okay. This is basically the basis for how Unix CPU schedulers work. Okay. Most Unix CPU schedulers implement some variant of MLFQ. The older ones actually implement MLFQ as is. Okay. More modern ones do some variants of this. Yeah. So here is what you have to do. Okay. So you cannot predict the length of the job, okay, but yet you want to somehow pick short jobs. Okay. What can you do? Okay. The only thing you can do is observe the behavior of a job, okay, and try to favor jobs based on how they are actually behaving in the system. Okay. So what behavior can you observe? Okay. The thing that a CPU scheduler can observe, okay, is whether a job, when it is actually given the CPU, okay, does it always finish its time slice or does it not finish its time? Does it block before its time slice expires? This you can observe. Okay, if you run a job, you know whether the job actually used up all of the time slice you gave it or did it stop somewhere in between and start doing I.O. that you can observe. So what this also means is you can observe whether jobs are what are called I/O bound jobs or CPU bound jobs, okay, based on how they are actually behaving in the system. Is that clear what I just said? So if you can observe I/O bound jobs, which jobs are I/O bound and which jobs are CPU bound, you can treat them differently. Okay? And by doing so, you can approximate the behavior of shortage jobbers. I'll show how to do that, but that's the basic insight. Okay, the insight is you don't know the length of the job, but you can observe what the job is doing. Okay? And you will extrapolate from this behavior. Okay? And the fundamental observation is that if the process is I/O bound, has been I/O bound in the recent past, it is likely to be I/O bound in the near future. Okay? You're assuming that the past is somehow going to predict how the job is going to behave in the future. Okay? So if the job was I/O bound now, it's likely to be I/O bound short while from now. If the job is CPU bound now, it's likely to remain so for some more time. Okay? You make this assumption. This is empirically shown. Okay? Jobs behavior can change across long periods of time, but over short period, the behavior, if it is doing I/O now, it's likely to continue to do that. But if it's running, maybe it's running in a loop. If you observed it run a few times, it might run for some more time. Okay? So you basically make a bet. Okay, the bet is that the past is a good predictor of the near future. The near past is a good predictor of the near future. Okay, on long periods of time, a job can cycle between being I/O bound and CPU bound. But over short periods of time, it's I/O bound now, it will remain so. Okay, these are some observations that we will use to develop this policy. Okay, so, and we'll see that the policy is adaptive. It can, as the job behavior changes, it also starts treating jobs differently. Okay, so it can basically adapt to how the job behavior changes. Okay. So let me show you what the policy is, and then we'll come back to understanding how it is approximating round robin, how does it figure out what to do and so on. So policy is simple. As the name suggests, multi-level feedback queue essentially says that there are multiple ready queues, okay, not one. Until now, we assume there's only one ready queue. Okay. Here there are more than one. Okay. And each one is given a priority. Okay. So here we show four ready queues. This is the highest priority ready queue. This is the next highest priority ready queue. The next highest and okay, so on. Okay. So priorities 1 through 4. Okay. And then each ready queue is also given a certain time slice. And the time slice is different across the ready queue. The highest priority queue has the shortest time slice in this technique. Okay. So this queue here, this is the highest priority time slice of 1 second, okay, or 1 millisecond. Okay, this one is 2, that's 4 and 8. Time slice doubles as you go to the next level. Okay, is that clear what I just said? There are multiple ready queues. Okay, they have priorities, they have time slices. Okay, as the priority drops, as you go to the lower priority queue, the time slice increases. Okay, these are the data structures for the algorithm. Okay, so here is how the algorithm actually works. Okay. Whenever a new job arrives into the system, we don't know anything about this job, so we always give it the benefit of the doubt and put it in the highest priority queue. Okay? So new jobs always join at the highest priority queue. So what the scheduler is simply doing is each queue, it is scheduling in round robin order. So you take this queue, you do round robin. You take this queue, you do round robin and so on. Okay? And because this is a priority queue, the policy states that if there is a high priority, you pick the highest priority queue that is non-empty, and you do round robin at that level until it becomes empty, and then you go to the next level and so on. Okay? So for instance, here there are 3 jobs. Okay? You will do round robin between these 3 jobs, okay, because that is the highest priority queue, until somehow this queue becomes empty. Okay, then you say, what is the next highest priority queue that's non-empty? In this case, let's say these jobs depart for whatever reason, then this is the next queue. Okay, and then you will do round robin here until this queue becomes empty and so on. So at each point you pick, and if while you are doing this a job arrives here, then at the next time slice you have to go back up here, okay, and do time slicing. Okay, so you always pick the highest priority queue that is non-empty, and you start doing round robin. Okay, so you do round robin at each priority level, okay, and you always pick the highest priority queue first. Okay, is that part clear? Okay. Yes, you have a question there.
But in that situation, wouldn't the second queue take less time than the first queue?
Wouldn't the second?
If no one takes the time slice as 2 and you only have one job,
yeah,
that's going to take 2 time slices, and the first one has 3 jobs of 1 time slice, so that's going to take 3 to finish.
Yes, so we haven't even said they will finish in one time slice each. All I'm saying is,
oh, that's how long each one is going to have.
That's how long each one gets. Okay, you run A, it gets one time slice. Well, once, or not one time slice, 1 second. Okay, because that's the quantum length there. If you run a job from here, when it gets to run for 2 seconds. If you run a job from here, it gets to run for 4 seconds. Okay? And this one gets to run for 8 seconds. Yes.
So say we empty the first priority,
right? Yeah. Yes. If you basically empty this one, you go to the next priority queue, and suppose a new job arrives. You said new job always arrives at the highest priority queue. At the next time slice, you have to go back up. Okay? Always, so basic algorithm is always as follows. Whenever the scheduler runs, you start scanning the highest priority queue. If this is empty, then you move here. If this is empty, you move here. Okay, so always start at the top. Okay, that's how you are going to move. Yes. What's the question?
When do we choose a priority?
When do you choose a priority? So I haven't talked about how jobs actually go into different queues. All I said is, I'll explain that, just 1 second. Okay? All I said is new jobs come and join the highest priority queue. And you should ask the question, so when does a job ever go into the lower priority queues? Yeah. So that's the basically, that's the magic that the multi-level feedback queue does. Here is where it actually takes advantage, or not advantage, exploits the behavior of the job. Okay? So the basic policy of how you assign jobs to queues is as follows. Whenever a job runs, it is given some time slice that corresponds to its queue's time slice. Okay? It could be any of these. It doesn't matter which one. Okay? But once it runs on the CPU, the scheduler just observes, has it used this entire time slice or has it not used the entire time slice. Okay? If it uses its entire time slice, it labels the job as CPU bound. Okay? And it drops it one level down immediately. Okay? So if it a job E, let's say, ran here, it got 2 seconds. Okay? If it uses its entire 2 seconds, it immediately gets labeled CPU bound and it has to go to the next lower level job, next lower priority. Okay? On the other hand, if this job was given 2 seconds, but it did not use its entire 2 seconds, let's say it did IO or it blocked for IO at the end of 1.5 seconds, which means it didn't use its time slice, then it actually gets to go one level up. Okay? So basic policy is, if you get a time slice, if you use up your time slice, you have to drop one level down. If you relinquish the CPU by blocking on some IO before your time slice expires, you are bumped up in priority. Okay, that's the basic policy. Okay, now let's try to understand how this matters. Okay, why? What does it do for us? Okay, so let's assume you have an IO bound task. Okay, what's an IO bound task? By definition, an IO bound task is one that spends most of its time doing IO and it does very little computation. That's the definition of an IO bound task. Okay, with this definition, which of the two behaviors will an IO bound task exhibit? If it's given a certain time slice, is it more likely to finish its time slice or is it more likely to not finish its time slice and do IO? Okay? It's not likely to finish its entire time slice. Because that's the definition. Spend most of its time doing IO, it does very short computation. Okay? By definition, the short computation will most likely finish before your time slice expires. Okay? So what does this mean for MLFQ? Okay. What happens to IO bound tasks in this algorithm? Okay. They will all end up in the highest priority queue or higher up queues because they will run, okay, and they will go back to doing IO, but next time they are active because they did not use up their entire time slice, they are bumped up in priority. So all IO bound tasks keep rising in priority. Okay. Now let's look at CPU bound tasks. CPU bound tasks are exact opposite definition. These are jobs that spend most of their time doing CPU, spend very little time doing IO. Okay, they are computationally bound. Okay, there are a lot of computations to do. Okay. So given a time slice, again you ask the question, which of the two scenarios are more likely for a CPU bound task? Will it finish its time slice and get kicked off the CPU, or will it actually block in the middle? Clearly, it is more likely to finish its time slice, okay, because it's CPU bound. Okay. So then you ask the question, so how does MLFQ treat CPU bound tasks? Where do they end up? they're keep going to keep dropping. Okay, so most CPU bound tasks end up in the lower priority queue. So a very simple example, let's say A is CPU bound, it ran for one time slice, it had a lot more computation to do, so it got kicked off. So it will go to the next priority queue. Okay, at some point this priority queue, let's say, empties, so it actually gets to run. It now gets 2 seconds of CPU time. It takes up its entire 2 seconds, still has a lot more computation to do. Okay, so now it used up its time slice, so MLFQ will drop it one more level down. Okay, so it will end up here. Let's suppose at some point these two queues are empty, MLFQ starts servicing jobs in this queue, it will get 4 seconds of CPU time. Okay, and it will again use up its 4 seconds because it has a lot of computation to do, it will drop here. Okay, so all CPU bound tasks drop, all IO bound tasks rise. Okay, so now what does this do for us? What did we get by doing all this fancy stuff? Okay, so IO bound tasks are here, CPU bound tasks are here. Okay, now as a scheduler, what is the scheduler doing to IO bound tasks? How is it treating them? Yes. Yep. So, IO bound tasks, because of their behavior, are given higher priority in the system. Okay, what does that mean? If you have 10 CPU bound tasks and 10 IO bound tasks and they are all in the ready queue, your CPU bound tasks are likely to be here and your IO bound tasks are likely to be there. Which ones get scheduled first? The IO bound tasks. Okay. What is the length of an IO bound task? CPU, what's the time, amount of time is spending on the CPU? Very little. So you are favoring jobs that are doing short CPU bursts, which are IO bound tasks by definition, over jobs that are having long CPU bursts, which are CPU bound tasks. So what have you approximated? Okay, you approximated the shortest job first policy. By not knowing anything about the job length, you are somehow started favoring jobs that are spending very little time on the CPU. Okay? So they are short CPU bursts. And you are basically not favoring these jobs. And this is exactly what you want. Okay, I mentioned early on that you have this effect where your long job might be holding a bunch of short jobs. That does not happen here. Because short jobs are given priority. They do their short computation. They go back to doing IO. This queue empties quickly. And you go back and give these long time slices to CPU bound tasks. Okay, and by giving long time slices, you also amortize your context switch over it. Okay, because these jobs are running for long anyway, so let them run for longer time slices. Okay, so this policy gives you lots of different things. It automatically identifies IO bound tasks and CPU bound tasks. It gives higher priority to IO bound tasks. By doing so, it approximates shortest job first. Okay, and it dynamically adjusts. This is the best part. Okay, so you have the CPU bound task, it suddenly wants to do a lot of IO. Okay, and the next time it gets a time slice, it will not use its time slice. It will start rising. Okay, because now it's starting to do IO. So soon it will end up in the higher priority queue. Okay, so a CPU bound task changes its behavior. The behavior of the scheduler also adjusts. Okay, so you don't even need to know. Okay, or you don't even have to assume that the behavior of the job is going to stay the same over its lifetime. As the behavior changes, how the job treats the scheduler treats the job also changes. Okay. And all this without any knowledge of the length of the job or any of it. Okay. So this basically, as I was saying, approximates your shortest job first policy without any of the knowledge of the length of jobs, and it adjusts based on the behavior of jobs. So you don't need to know as the job behavior changes, it adjusts. Okay. So next time we will actually look at examples, okay, of how this works, but let's stop here for today.